Hello and welcome to episode 76 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Well, hello, Matt. Here we are for episode 76. Another one is nearly in the can.
Yeah, you've just wished away the next 45 minutes or so. We're continuing in our relentless pursuit of the number 100. And at that point, we will do something different. Or not, as the case may be. How's your week been?
Well, it's been good fun. Today, of course, Alistair Cook has resigned from playing international cricket. That's a fundamentally important day, significant for the greatest player in terms of his record ever for England to have retired. So well done, Alistair. Other than that, it's been pretty busy. Lots of different meetings with different people. We've had even caught up with you, didn't I, last week?
We did.
In the same location, so that was Pickman as well. So that's always a pleasure. So we've had it's been a good week. What about yourself?
Well, Watford still top of the Premiership, not Premier nor a ship. And I actually went to the game yesterday. So I'm a bit croaky because there was much shouting. Very enjoyable afternoon, and just sort of work now clicking into. School holidays are ending, getting back into actually doing stuff and people being available and invoices being processed and all good stuff like that as well. So, kids go back to school this week. And so some sort of sense of normality around the Ballantyne household will be restored.
Yes. It's the EPL now. I've noticed that now EPL has become a recognised and acceptable phrase to use when discussing the Football League or the Premier League or whatever it's called.
It's this sort of encroaching Americanism, which...
Like I think the NFL.
AFL. Which we will just come to regret as we continue to separate ourselves from the continent of which we are a part and try to align ourselves with other parts of the world who really, quite frankly, don't care about us. Actually, in other news, I also have now got my finger out and have my Irish passport application fully in motion. So I will, as I describe it, be acting upon my Northern Ireland backstop position and maintaining my rights to be able to have free movement across the European Union. So, good luck to the rest of you.
What a rat leaving this.
I know. There was this, see the thing that was published today saying that an opinion poll survey of people in Northern Ireland, something like 56% now say if Brexit goes ahead, then reunification of Ireland becomes a preferred option. There's some weird stuff ahead.
That's preferred option maybe for the people of Northern Ireland. I think you'll find that the people of the Republic of Ireland will have something to say about that, given that Northern Ireland is a drain on the exchequer in enormous proportions. It's the last thing they need.
Well, that's one way of looking at it, but interesting times. It's good to see the politicians are straight back to Westminster before you can say overinflated ego. We've got them fighting against each other already. So the predictions of political craziness over this autumn have become true already.
Yeah, I think I've been saying for a while that September is going to be properly grim in political terms, or spectacularly entertaining, depends on how you look at it. And we're straight into it. It's daggers drawn already.
I know. So there we go. We're not going to talk about that anymore today, though, because I'm sure there's going to be plenty more material over the next few weeks to be able to stare at and gawp open-mouthed, wondering what on earth is it that's going on at the moment.
Well, once we get a little bit of clarity, because we will have to get clarity, we are now reaching Brexit crunch point. So at the end of this month, or sort of very early in November, we will start to see what it's going to look like. And then we can start to do some analysis of what actually that means for business and people in IT. So we've got that to look forward to.
Absolutely. That's when the good consulting work starts, if you were to be overly cynical about it all. Anyway, so what are we going to talk about this week? So we've got the WB40 Book Club back again. And we are looking at a book called The Culture Code. And then we're going to talk a bit about blockchain, which is a subject that we've touched on before, but I thought it would be worth giving it a bit of a revisit. So we're going to talk about where we think it's all at. So without further ado, let's press on. Okay, so this week, or over this fortnight, we've been looking at The Culture Code, which is a book by a chap called Daniel Coyle. And it looks at what are the sorts of things that you need to be able to build good culture in a team to be able to get it to perform well. Now, it's confession time, isn't it, Mr. Weston?
It is. I've been a sinful podcast host in as much as I didn't actually get around to buying and reading this book. I was going to, and then time went by, and then I realised it was all too late, and there was no way I was going to read it. But I have done the next best thing, in as much as I did some reading around it, and also there's a, we could put this on the page afterwards, actually a link, because there's a video of a fairly lengthy talk that he did to the RSA last year, or I guess when the book was published, which I guess is at least as good as reading it, because you know you get it in his words.
That's, yeah, I mean, it basically is the York Notes of the modern age, really, isn't it? I did read it, and I went beyond the usual three-chapter rule. I got to chapter 8, and I do intend, actually, to be able to read more of it as well. It's very, I thought it was really well written. To some extent, I mean, some of the books that we've read recently that we've been a bit dismissive of, particularly Be More Pirate, and then the one about... what was the one about?
That one about different historical figures and yes. What that bloke reckons they were thinking.
Yes. The, oh God, what are the Greek things called? The Psychopaths, Stoics. That's the one. Stoics, sorry, yes, the Stoics. I thought both of those books were incredibly individualistic, looking back on it in comparison to this, because actually the format and the structure of this thing is very similar. There's lots of... They're probably more relevant and they're better researched stories about different situations in and mostly in the modern world rather than being ancient Greek through to everything. And the thing about this book that I thought actually engaged me was it was about how you get people to work well together rather than how to be a high-performing individual basically trampling on the bodies of the people that you're trying to be able to get
yeah,
past.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's something that it appealed to me in terms of the philosophy behind this one compared to, the as you say, the pretty win-it-all-cost kind of nonsense of the others.
And at the core of the book, there's this idea that basically there are three... key skills that teams that want to be able to have an effective culture amongst them need to do. The first is to be able to build a psychologically safe environment. The second is to be able to, through that, then be able to open up, to be able to share vulnerability and for it not to be command and control and for people to be able to be honest with each other. There's a fascinating story about an airline jet that had an engine failure and a catastrophic failure of all its hydraulic systems, and how the crew were able to be able to use very, very open and short communication to be able to fairly miraculously not kill everybody. And then the final part, which I haven't got through to yet, but is the idea of establishing purpose and sort of reading between the lines. That's probably going to be similar sorts of stuff to that people like Dan Pink have talked a lot about around the need for purpose for people to be able to have a sense of common interest, basically. So it's not a particularly, you know, massively revelatory thing, but just the way it's all put together, there's some interesting, very interesting stories. It seems to be a fairly solid set of simple ideas. It's not overly reliant on a ludicrous metaphor. And say very well written and seems to be very well researched as well. So I was kind of, you know, it's worth a read.
I enjoyed listening to the guy talk, and I also, you know, I read around it and I read some excerpts, and I thought I like the premise, and I think it's something that we should all be aware of from time to time, and we all need to remember that. You do have to provide ways for people to become a good team. And if I think back to my experience in that area, as somebody, a softy manager, really, it's always been, from my point of view, your team takes the plaudits and you take the criticism. That's the way it works, you know. you have to go and face up when things go badly. But when things go well, then you make sure that the team get the credit. And that's kind of the management style that I've always in the main that I've employed. And because of that, I think that allows people to be more able to come to me and tell me that they've fouled up because daft old Chris will take their app. I would say that it can work quite well and it helps to create good teams, but I think you have to be careful. And I guess I see this from people who I've worked with, and whether this happened to me, I don't know, because you never quite know how people see you. But I've seen managers who have been all too happy to share. I don't know how this is going to work out, guys, or I've made this mistake before, and it can lead to a lack of confidence in what they're doing. As a that people almost sometimes want to be told, "Don't worry, I know what I'm doing, and this can't possibly fail." Whereas in their groups, they need to be able to share and to be kind of, in that hierarchy piece, they want to be safe in their peers, but not necessarily to have that same relationship with their manager. And I do think that's something that from what I heard and read around this was missing a little bit. And I think also, so this is me being overly critical, because actually I like the premise, but this idea that once you've done that, once you've shown vulnerability or whatever, everything works out, because probably the safest space in theory is your family, really, unless you've got some sort of psychopathic family, which it does happen. That's the place where everybody knows everybody inside out, but that doesn't necessarily mean it works as a in the sense that this guy is talking about. And I think it's a bit, there's a bit of idealism in there, but there's nothing wrong with idealism. I like it's nice to be it's nice to reach for something better, I guess.
Yeah, I guess as you're talking there, it reminded me of things like holacracy, which I have to confess, I think is possibly the most over-bureaucratic thing that I've ever seen. But there are lots of other things as well about people looking at non-hierarchical forms of management of organisations. Was it the leader-servant and these kind of concepts? And I think that there is a lot of cultural stuff tied up in the idea of the omnipotence and complete, absolute knowledge that our superiors must have in organisations, because if they didn't have all of that, why are they above us in the hierarchy of the organisation? And that kind of cultural thing, I think, is very, very deep-rooted. And that's one of the things I've seen many times over the years as people go into management positions. It's what I charmingly refer to as my manager is a wanker theory, which is having for many years thought their manager was a wanker because they didn't actually appear to have omnipotent powers and total knowledge of everything. When people first go into management positions, suddenly confronted with the obvious fact that actually managers don't have omnipotence and complete knowledge of everything, and therefore a massive kind of personal crisis, because they thought they'd somehow be imbued with that, in the same way that I think most of us think that at some point you grow up and you suddenly become an adult, and it doesn't really happen like that. You just kind of slowly mature. And the I don't know, but the thing that strikes me more than that is that it's concepts of meritocracy that are existing so deeply into management culture in many Western countries, and I think definitely in the UK, so that people must be in those positions because they deserve to be, because surely it's all fair. And yet everybody knows really that's not the case at all. Concepts of omnipotence that must be imbued in these people, and that's a kind of, people who are taking home ridiculous salaries to be able to be, the senior leaders in big corporations now want that myth to be there as well, because otherwise how can they? Well, unless they are psychopathic, and we've already discussed how that might be the case in many cases, but how do you possibly self-justify yourself the many multiples that you are getting paid in comparison to the rank and file in your organisation if it's not because of your utter awesomeness? but it doesn't work. And there's such an in all of that, and then on top of that, you have this incredibly individualistic culture that permeates into organisations. And in no better is it expressed where, and I've seen this in loads of companies, where you are either a manager or an individual contributor. And then I have people coming to me saying, how do we get these people to work more as a team? And I'd say, well, the first thing is don't refer to them as individual contributors, because what you're doing is you are defining them and then probably bonusing them on the basis of the performance management systems that you use, on the basis of them being individuals with no care for anybody around them. All of that stuff is... You know, there's a lot of complexity in that. There's a lot of deep cultural stuff that goes back centuries that exists in many UK organisations and global organisations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been reflecting on it as I was listening to this guy talk, and he used the anecdote about I can't remember who it is, but and I don't think he even said it, but there's, you know, the company who says, you know, we don't have any. No brilliant dickheads in this, or no brilliant arseholes, or whatever the saying is, that they will not have anybody, they will not take anybody who they just think isn't. It doesn't matter how good they are, if they're going to be a knob, they're not going to have them. And I think that's great. I mean, that's something we should absolutely applaud, because I've seen so many examples where people who are brilliant also know they're brilliant and break systems and hierarchies, and not that systems and hierarchies are all important, you know what I mean, but they break structures that are working for everybody because they want to be different. And also people who are, so in a company I worked in a couple of years ago, it wasn't going very well, and the private equity guys brought in a guy to essentially come in and sort it out, and he was appalling in so many ways. He really didn't have any self-awareness. He was almost a pretty much like a talking MBA. He really knew the theory of everything, but his ability to translate that into something that worked was zero. But he was so his personal style was so aggressive and overbearing that everybody kind of had to orbit around him, and it was a disaster. The whole thing was a disaster, because there was no safe place at that point, because he would pick everything apart, and but it would be right all the time. And whether you got into fights as I tended to do, or whether you rolled over and just took it, there was no real good way out of it. It was just a you could see everything breaking down in front of your eyes.
Yeah. One of the other things that the book has got me thinking about, though, is this idea of building safety in the workplace, psychological safety in the workplace. In a few days' time, I'm going to interview Neil Usher, who is a workplace specialist, and he's quite a player in the space, saying there's lots of myths going around about what makes for a good physical workspace, office space, and whatever. But what we're going to talk about is whether there's such a thing as a digital workplace. Now, my thinking is that increasingly we are providing places of work that exist purely in the digital realm. So tools like Slack or Microsoft Teams or any of these kind of things, we need to think of them not as repositories of data. We need to think of them as workplaces, in the same way that we think of an office as a workplace, or a home office as a workplace, or a factory floor as a workplace. And one of the things out of that, it's a sort of recurring theme I've had over the last few years. These pieces of software as workplaces, what do we do to be able to get people to feel that they are safe places to work? Doing a rollout of some Office 365 stuff at the moment, and one of the things this is really triggered for me is when people first open Outlook, as the data starts to be able to be trundled down into their device to cache, Outlook has this horrible habit of not showing you anything, and they're just building up from random points. So the first time you go into your email client, all of your data appears to be missing. And what does that do for the first experience of using these services in terms of thinking about how safe and reliable these things are? But then also the evergreen software that we have now, which is constantly changing. I've for some while now said that one of the big problems for me with agile software development is the user experience of constantly changing software, which it might be getting better, but as it's constantly confusing, it's almost like gaslighting users as you challenge them to be able to find the thing that was over there last week but now has mysteriously disappeared. And if you draw that to, an analogy with physical workplaces, it would be like subtly moving the furniture every night just to be able to see what happens. And that sort of thing drives people insane. And I do think we should be starting to think about the role of creating safe places to work in digital realms as much as we do in physical teams and the groups of people and all the rest of it.
I think, yeah, I understand what you mean. I think also in terms of working digitally and collaboratively, there's a whole point about how, what do you put on the digital record, isn't it? If you've been online for a long time, people like you and I, and people who have worked in tech and have therefore had email since, the early 90s, and you have grown up knowing that if you post something on Usenet or something, somebody might well one day bring it out and use it against you. And therefore, electronic collaboration tools and email and, Slack, and Rocket Chat, whatever it might be, you don't put on there necessarily everything you're thinking because it's not a sensible thing to do. It's something, you make sure that what is on there is a reflection. It's the reflection of you that you want people to see. That happens subconsciously. That's not necessarily a conscious thing. And I remember sort of realizing this once upon a time when we introduced Link, or whatever it used to be called before it was called Link, Office something communicator or something. And at the time I was working in a team, and it was very busy actually, and we were often working weekends, but I would come home with my computer, and I had a docking station at home and my desk, and I'd plug my computer into my docking station, and I'd fire up, I'd leave it there, and I would leave it on because it would just mean it would be easier for me. If I wanted to go and quickly write something down, or I thought of something, I'd do that. But I wouldn't necessarily work all weekend. I would very rarely do that. And I remember going to work one day after having maybe done a couple of hours week at work at the weekend, and somebody who had been working all weekend, bless them, saying, "Gosh, that was the weekend flow by." He said, "I was working on this thing all weekend, and I saw you were working too." And of course, I'd set my Link client or whatever it was called up to show me available all the time, as if I was online all the time. So they thought I was working all weekend, and I sort of nodded and said, "Phew, it was, yes, that was a that's the book." But then you realise actually that you're the brand. I don't know, it's not the brand really, but what is seen of what you do. It does have an effect. Now we've all known people that have done that all the time, haven't we? There's loads of people through, whether before digital technology, walking around with a piece of paper in their hands, trying to look busy and things like that. That's always happened, but it's just now happening in a digital way as much as it is in any other. And how do you create platforms and technologies which are, safe, if you like, if they're not going to be used against you in a court of law?
Well, it's certainly got the thinking going, and as I say, I'm going to be exploring a bit of this more with Neil Usher when I interview him, and that should be going out next week, depending on where we get our various interviews lined up. So, Daniel Coyle, The Culture Code, The Secrets of Highly Successful Groups, well worth a look, which gives us the delight of now picking the next book in the WB40 Book Club.
We're going to have to press the...
Okay, hold on. Firing up. There we go. Okay, so and the next book in the WB40 Book Club is going to be another one from Andrew Doran's list of things. It's a book called Everybody Lies, by Seth Stevens Davidovits. So there we go. Everybody Lies, the next book in the book club. We'll be reviewing it in episode 78.
So next today, we're going to talk about blockchains and cryptocurrencies, aren't we? Something that we've touched on quite a lot recently. And I guess it's because it's almost ubiquitous, isn't it, in terms of every time you pick up a tech article or look at anything on the internet, there's some bloody blockchain thing or something about Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency. And they are fascinating at the end of the day. It's a really fascinating technology. It's a fundamental technology in as much as it changes the way we think about how we solve certain problems. But there are undoubtedly significant issues with the technology as it exists in terms of blockchain. That's why we have our countries which have recently been overtaken by Bitcoin in terms of energy use, very popular feature. And the question really is, where is it going? Because there's a lot of money going into blockchain as well. You've pointed me at an Economist article, series of articles, which is pretty good, and it goes into cryptocurrency and blockchain, and it's really important to make the difference between cryptocurrency and blockchain. And as much as cryptocurrencies are built on blockchain, but not everything that's blockchain is cryptocurrency. And they go into some, not too much detail, but enough to point out some of the scaling issues and the trust issues that are there. But there are even bigger problems than that, aren't there, in the way that they're being used. They're being used to fleece people out of a lot of money. And also to fleece people out of a lot of money, both out of their savings and out of their investment funds that they're putting into to spurious coins being made, and also by creating technology which is never really going to fly, but is getting lots of people investing into it.
Yes, we'll put a link to the Economist articles. Every quarter they have a technology special, and there's about 9 articles or so all about various aspects of what's going on with distributed ledgers, blockchain, Bitcoin and other currencies. I think there's 3 things we're going to think about. The first is blockchain and distributed ledgers as a platform for replacing money. The second is this weird phenomenon of the ICO, the initial coin offering. And then we'll look a little bit about where are distributed ledgers headed from what we've seen so far. Now, the currency thing, the Economist's conclusion is none of this works as a currency. It's become too ridiculously speculative, and it doesn't fulfill on a few of the core things that a currency needs to be able to do, like to be able to be a reliable form of exchange. I'm a bit hedgehog-like with this one, but I years back now said I thought that Bitcoin was solving the wrong problem, and that Bitcoin said that they were replacing a lack of trust in money with a new way to be able to do the equivalent of money. And my argument is that actually we have never lost trust in money. What we've lost trust in is financial institutions. And I really struggle to see that you will replace trust in banks, which even though they have proven themselves to be utterly disreputable at every given opportunity over the last 20 years, still we all use them and we kind of understand how they work. Enough to be able to have some level of trust that the money is there and it tends to be there. And shifting that trust into a very, very complex set of cryptography that was created by a man or woman who travels under a pseudonym and remains anonymous, and that very few people understand the detailed complexities of, I just think is beyond credible when it's not money that we've lost trust in, it's banks. If we have lost trust in them at all.
It's a fair point, and that's the part of the attraction of cryptocurrency, isn't it? And as much as it's decentralized and there isn't a bank, but as you say, the people, I guess the question is do people understand how banks work and how financial instruments work and how currency hedging and leveraging and all this kind of weird and wonderful things work? Do they understand how that work? those work, but were up until recently happy to trust banks. And let's face it, continue to trust banks because that's the only game in town, really.
But also, so those banks are generally underwritten by national governments, which distributed ledger-based currencies most certainly aren't.
No, that's right. And what the financial crisis of 10 years ago taught us is that those governments are willing to step in and shore up the whole thing when it goes wrong. And nobody's going to shore up a cryptocurrency if that goes wrong. That's for certain. But the question really is, what is the lack of a centralized institution? And as you say, replacing by a fairly impenetrable technology, is that going to work for people whose jobs and whose experiences have been based around a level of due diligence and faith based on the fact that, well, I'm going to do bank with HSBC because it's the biggest, or I'm going to bank with Barclays because my dad did, or, you know, all those kind of things. There's a lot of human, there's a lot of emotion that all goes into those decisions. And let's face it, all financial decisions are driven by emotion, really, rather than logic. That's the fact that the idea that are driven by logic is a fallacy.
Yeah, well, so, this is the whole realm of behavioural economics, of course.
So I guess what I'm saying is I agree with you, but what will it take for cryptocurrencies and blockchain itself to become more trusted?
So will it be initial coin offerings? So ICOs, they're a little bit like initial... what's the P stand for in IPO?
I don't know, but you're right.
But yeah, anyway, so when a company first issues shares to general, initial public offering.
Yes, indeed.
When company initially it issues out shares to the general public for them to be able to buy, or institutions for them to be able to buy, an ICO is a similar sort of idea, except you're not buying shares. What you're buying is a number of pieces of a virtual cryptocurrency that has been set up by the company that is probably doing something else, but thinks that they can use a blockchain with a cryptocurrency on top of it to be able to fund it. This is utter nonsense, isn't it? I mean, this is just pure Emperor's New Clothes stuff at a ludicrous scale.
It does appear to be. So I went to a blockchain event last month, and when it was in a session about this, and there's a lot of really good reasons to do an ICO if you're somebody who owns a technology, for example, or you're trying to raise money for your company. And I still haven't got my head around why this is a good thing for anybody else but the person that's doing the money raising, because the idea of an ICO is that you don't dilute your shareholding, so you're not giving away shares, you're giving away this other
made up currency.
So there's absolutely no collateral in it, or there's nothing in it at all, but people do. And there's in the article that you sent me, the Economist article, there's the numbers that said, and this chap that did this session the other week said these numbers too, and it's by early August this year, ICOs had raised almost $18 billion from institutional investors and individuals. Last year, in 2017, there were 221 ICOs, and they raised $3.7 billion. So in 1.5 years, we've got more than $20 billion raised. $20 billion for ICOs that could be worth nothing. And you can only imagine that this is down to the kind of Bitcoin frenzy that where you could buy a Bitcoin for, you know, a few cents a few years ago, and recently you sold them. Was it $20,000 they got to? Yeah. I don't know, some silly number. It's about $6,000 now, isn't it? But everybody wants that, don't they? Everybody wants that. Everybody wants to be the person, because everybody seems to know somebody who knows somebody who got into this coin when it was 10p, sold them all at £1,000, and is now, you know, living in a mansion on the Côte d'Azur with a yacht and a hundred serving girls from Bali on the yacht. Everybody seems to know somebody who got into this position by investing it early, and now is fabulously wealthy. So everybody wants to be that person. The fact that actually that person probably doesn't exist. Or as somebody said to me the other day, you know, they know somebody who's a cryptocurrency millionaire. But what does that? What good is that to anybody? What good is having cryptocurrencies that are worth $1 million? Because I know if I had cryptocurrencies worth $1 million, I'd want $1 million. And actually, before it got to $1 million, I'd have wanted $500,000 or the $10,000. That would have been enough for me. It's like, you know, before we started the podcast, we talked about Watford having to get into the top of the league, and we talked about Leicester. And when Leicester won the league, I was working in Leicester, and there were loads of people in that company who, in their normal kind of stupid way, had a bet on Leicester at the start of the season at, I don't know, 100 to 1 or whatever it was, probably more than that, I can't remember now, 500 to 1, I think some of the odds were. And as you get to Christmas, and of course, and the team are near the top, people start cashing that in, don't they? They go, you know, they can cash in and get maybe 20 to 1. And maybe somebody's put 10 quid on and they get £200 back. They're happy with that. The fact that you can get your 500 to 1 when they win is irrelevant because they're not going to win. The fact that they did win is kind of neither here nor there because it's not going to happen. And that's the same with cryptocurrency. You'd be cashing out. If you've got any sense, you're cashing out, aren't you? A long time before it reaches some ridiculous number.
So it's the fear of missing out in writ large on this, isn't it? It's and there is those stories, isn't it? It's about, you know, the person who was one of the members of the early Apple team but then left early and so ended up with $3,000 of shares, or the woman who was paid $200 to be able to design the Nike logo and then never got any royalty from it because she'd just done it as a one-off job, or and that kind of, there's a sort of sneery, yeah, look what you lost. But of course, actually, most people, you do those kind of deals all the time because that's how you just get by, because most of it never turns into massive things. It's a massive great thing about greed, basically, the ICO model, isn't it?
It is. So everybody now thinks, well, actually, this is a and I talked to a guy, you know, who decided last year he was going to, he'd got about £5,000 he wanted to put into cryptocurrencies. Because he could afford to, you know, he had some money to spare, and he thought, well, do you know what? I could put it in the bank, I could put in shares in, I don't know, this company or that company, but actually, some of this money I'm just going to buy these cryptocurrencies with, and if one of them goes mental, then I'm, you know, happy days. And all you need is loads and loads of people with that sort of cash knocking about. And guess what? There is a lot of cash knocking about because there aren't many good instruments to put your money into. So it's almost a shot to nothing. And somebody, like any Ponzi scheme, it's the people who get in early manage to make a few quid, and somebody gets it in the pants at the end. And that's the way ICOs are working. So, yes, I think you're right. Personally, I think you're right to be highly cynical about ICOs. I think they're driven by no sense whatsoever. There's no good can come out of buying coins.
Some people will make money, but then they always do within any sort of bubble kind of thing. So that then brings us, so the currencies look like a busted flush, ICOs look like a massive con, but there's still all of this interest in distributed ledgers as a technology. Where is it heading? Because, and again, if you get into some of the detail of the Economist articles, they talk about how, you know, people wanting to make private distributed ledgers, that they then start to remove some of the things like immutable transactions, or some of the, you know, cryptography is lessened down a bit, or to be able to make it more of an enterprise thing. And what you've ended up with then, surely, is just a bit of a shit database.
Yeah, a very, very poor database that doesn't work. That doesn't work very well. And I think a lot of those individual kind of, there was an Accenture effort, wasn't it, to take away the fact that you couldn't change things. You could change things on their blockchain, which seems to be, you know, I understand why they had a go at it, but it just seems to be a fundamentally silly thing to do. I like distributed ledgers as a concept, and I think there are things that could be done with them, but I don't think blockchain is the one that's going to change the world, just because, as you said, that the scaling problems are there. There are cryptocurrencies that people have pointed me out. There's one called IOTA. But again, when you get into these things, they're good.
IOTA?
Yeah.
You haven't got an iota's chance of. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. But even when you get into these, you look at what they do, and then deep down in the gubbins, in the workings, there are ways that the network can kind of rebalance itself, or the individual regions can choose to rebalance the value, and it all looks a bit dodgy. That there's an interesting example though is the one some of the guys I'm working with at the moment, and they've got this cryptocurrency which is backed by collateral. And the idea is it can never go wrong, because it's always backed by more collateral than the currency is worth. So it kind of unwinds, if you know what I mean. So if you essentially liquidize the asset in the collateral, which pays for the fact that you owe this person money.
So it's like a book token.
A book token.
Yeah, you know book tokens. You remember these things that they used to have?
Book tokens.
Yeah.
Good boys and girls.
Exactly. I mean, those were always had the money behind them.
I suppose, but I think a book token, if this might be a bit of a rabbit hole, but a book token is like any kind of token, isn't it? And if you get a token for, if you had a token for House of Fraser recently, if you went to House of Fraser now to try to buy your new driving gloves, or whatever, if you buy from House of Fraser, you would find that the token was worthless because House of Fraser went into administration.
Yes. I don't know. So, I mean, the other things that people talk about are things like property, land registry type applications, and, you know, other things. But again, I'm sure things will come from this, but I'm still, at the moment, I desperately struggle to find anything where either the idea of immutable transactions that can be dealt with by multiple parties can't be better dealt with by a proper database of some description. You know, reading in the articles as well, it talks about, you know, where banks have trouble because the interfacing between their operational systems is really hard inter-organisation. You go, that's a fundamental problem with their underpinning systems. That's got nothing to do with solving that with blockchain. If the banks should have learned anything in the last few years, TSB have found out recently, it's that the systems that they have had since the 1970s need to be replaced and stop building crap on top of them. And isn't it, blockchain would just be another layer of stuff they can't properly control. And then the idea of having systems where there is no one organisation in control of it, for all of those things like, you know, land registry. Well, actually, no, I want the government to manage land registration. I don't want that to be locked away in some weird bit of technology. And I struggle to think of examples where you really want something that has no ownership, that ultimately you can't hold them responsible for it.
Oh, we're going to get the old man yells at cloud thing in a minute, aren't we? I understand what you're saying, but if it was cheaper and more effective for it to be decentralized, wouldn't it be better to do it that way rather than paying some people to sit in the offices and poking at forms and filing cabinets and all that kind of... It's like you might have said that about the computer. People probably did say that about computerization. I want my documents in a filing cabinet. I don't want them in some magic box where I don't really know. But, it doesn't really exist.
Yeah, but surely if the internet has taught us anything over the last 30 years, it's that actually you end up having it all centralized anyway. You know, all of our data has ended up centralized in Google, Amazon, Facebook, to some extent Apple, to some extent Microsoft. Right, that's not decentralized. The technology underpinning it, you know, they have complex, distributed, really smart, sharded data centers, but it's all sitting with a very few number of people.
That's an economic issue, isn't it? It's not a technological
issue. No,
but the technology of the internet is still distributed. Your email is going to go by some path that you can't necessarily, you can these days, to be honest, with the way everybody's connected, but... The theory, your email can go part via any number of email servers that you don't know about until when you press the button. But the economic model absolutely has ended up with the five richest princes of Europe, you know, owning all the computers or whatever the quote was.
So, I mean, maybe that's just the way it heads eventually. I don't know. But I'll get off my old man shouting at the cloud thing. But I think we're 10 years away. Maybe five before anybody will show me anything that I'll look at and I'll go, oh yeah, that's quite interesting. And I thought this was going to be much much quicker to be able to find useful applications for it. The first thing I wrote about blockchain was probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And I thought by now we'd be seeing stuff where you go, oh, that's an obvious use for it. I just don't think we're there yet.
Oh, well, there's a challenge. We'll have to see what we can find.
So, okay, if you've got a great idea for a blockchain application, let us know, and then we'll do an ICO on it. It'll be super.
Well, another week passes us by, and another episode of WB40 is in the can. That's great news, isn't it? We're just knocking them out, sort of shelling peas.
Yes, it is. And another exciting show next week, as I mentioned earlier, unless something untoward happens in the next 24 hours, we'll have an interview with the workplace guru, Neil Usher, which would be great. Between now and then, I've also been very pleased to say that Watford will remain joint top of the Premier League until the next show. And I've also got my 400th week note coming out on Friday, which is going to be a special one, although I don't yet know how, but you can find that at blog.mattballantyne.com if you want to see my weekly ramblings.
That's a big effort, isn't it? 400 weeks.
I know.
That's like 5 years if I'm using my well-honed mathematics skills.
Anyway, in charge of the WB40 accounts is Mr. Chris Weston.
Oh dear.
That explains a lot. Anyway, so join us next week and we'll have hopefully that interview with my workplace man talking about what is a digital workplace. Should be interesting. That's it. Join us again next week. You can find us at wb40podcast.com, wb40podcast on Twitter, on Stitcher, on iTunes, and all other good podcasting platforms. Leave us a review, because we're needy.